I've warned us, warned everybody a month ago that we were going to cover the subject of Moses, the plagues, and the Exodus. So hopefully you've had a chance to pick up some of that. We've had a few messages on that subject. And in only a month, we have the Spring Holy Days, where there's a focus on coming out of Israel, coming out of sin. So I thought it would be good for us to get a grip on this general idea of Moses, the plagues, and the Exodus. So if we take a look, I want to give a little background first. If we look in Genesis 28 and verses 2 through 4, it was recently the message I gave was why God made a nation out of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and built from just 70 people, built an entire nation of millions of people. So we go back to the original promise here to Jacob in Genesis 28, starting in verse 2, and take yourself a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may be an assembly of peoples, and give you the blessing of Abraham to you and your descendants with you, that you may inherit the land in which you're a stranger, which God gave to Abraham. So he's extending the Abrahamic blessing on down to Abraham's grandson, Jacob, and Jacob's offspring. So we have this, the blessing, and he was told, be fruitful and multiply. Well, then we have evidence of being fruitful and multiply. If we go to Exodus in chapter 1, starting in verse 1, and it tells us who of Jacob's family went from the land of Canaan, went down into Egypt. And we read the names of his children, and it says, and their descendants, a total of 70 persons. So because his son Joseph was already in Egypt. So there were 70 of them in Egypt who were Jacob's descendants. So from that small start, from Jacob to the 70 that were his offspring, and they were there, and while Joseph, Jacob's son, was there, he became basically the ruler of Egypt under the Pharaoh. We read that in Genesis 41, starting in verse 40. In Genesis 41, 40, you shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. That's a pretty big responsibility. So if the Pharaoh, meaning the king of the land, appointed one of us and said, you're in charge, except for me, you're the boss of everybody, so what you say goes. Pretty big responsibility. Better not screw that up. At verse 41, Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. So there was a way that young Joseph, who was about 30 at the time, could put his administrative stamp and use his intellect and wisdom to prepare Egypt to receive, even though they didn't know it, to receive the descendants of Jacob, and Jacob coming into Egypt as they left the famine in Canaan. And it was generations later, we read in Exodus 1, verse 8, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Now, king or Pharaoh, the King James will interchange the terms here. So this was beyond the life of Joseph, beyond the life of Joseph's sons. In other words, there arose a new Pharaoh who didn't know him. Ever have a boss, new boss that came in and didn't know the old boss or the one before, didn't know how things were working, and comes into the company and says, I'm going to make some changes here. I've been through that. I suspect most of you have been through that, where somebody comes in and they pay no regard to history. Well, this is what we have here. Verse 10 in Exodus 1, come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, the Israelites, and it happen in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us and go up out of the land. You see, in verse 9, he says, there's more of them than there are of us. Well, that sounds like a fine howdy-do, and you can see the defensive posture that this new pharaoh is taking. We got to be careful here. We have to keep them in subjection, or they could just take us over. Verse 11, therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, and it lists those. So you have now the descent of the descendants of Jacob, their descent into slavery under this particular new pharaoh, this new king. So who had no regard for Joseph and the history of the matter. Now, if we look in, and of course they're reproducing, and Pharaoh was concerned about that. Well, got to stop this. How are we going to stop this level of reproduction? And Exodus 1 and verse 15, the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives. That'd be an interesting convention to be a mouse in the corner and hear how that went about. Of whom one was named Shiphrah and the other Puah. And he said, verse 16, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it's a son, you shall kill him, but if it's a daughter, then she shall live. Infanticide, post-birth abortion. They're going to stop the growth of these foreign peoples, as it were, stop the growth of the house of Israel. Let the daughters live. We can integrate them into, but we don't want warriors being raised up, is really the implication here. So, and of course, did the midwives follow this? Let's read on in Exodus 1, verse 17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but save the male children alive. Well, pretty irritating for the Pharaoh. Verse 18, so the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're lively and give birth before the midwives came to them. And if you believe that story, we've got the London Bridge in Arizona. There is one there. So that was their story, because they were protecting the baby boys in Egypt, the Israelite boys, from being killed at that time. So who was one of those baby boys who would have otherwise died? And we read about that in Exodus 2, starting in verse 1. And we read about the birth of a beautiful child named Moses. Verse 2, the woman conceived, bore a son, and she saw he was a beautiful child. She hid him for 3 months. Why? Well, if a newborn baby boy and the Pharaoh wanted babies killed, that would be one that the Pharaoh would likely kill. So she hid the baby. How do you hide a baby? Some of you have made known that babies make noises. Babies make messes. Babies can be, I can identify you very carefully. I know that I have a family history book in Minnesota for the conflicts between the natives and the settlers, and the way they kept the babies from crying is they stuffed their mouths full of grass so that they couldn't be identified. So that when there was a battle going on, they couldn't say, well, there's somebody over here. How do you keep a baby quiet? But 3 months she had to keep the baby quiet. But notice in verse 3, when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, laid it by the reeds by the riverbank. How would that help? Well, a three-month-old isn't quite at the crawling stage yet. Might be able to flip over if they're... But if they put in a basket, weave a basket, and make it waterproof, why the river? The rushing sound of the water is going to muffle it. There's the reeds along the river that will act as a muffler, as it were. And then his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. Now, we read later that Moses had an older sister named Miriam, so we assume that's the sister there, because we don't read about any other sisters. So we had a close relationship. And those of you that have a younger brother or sister, and you know that older sibling feeling of responsibility, and the mother couldn't be right there, or that would be in a flag, an identifier. Oh, yoo-hoo, you're protecting a baby. But so the sister watched over baby Moses. Now, Moses was adopted, found by a daughter of Pharaoh. She was, and she, oh, this sweet little baby, you know, and she didn't have a baby, so she adopted him. But he was a nursing baby. Well, what are you going to do? And the little girl said, I can find you a wet nurse to nurse it. And so Moses' own mother was then hired to be the nurse for her own child. How fortuitous at that point. And so Moses grew up in Pharaoh's court. He understood court politics, as it were, where the who was in charge of what. We read that Moses had military campaigns, was well-trained and well-educated as an Egyptian. And at age 40 years old, we read in Acts 7, verse 23, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. Now, I don't know, and the record here is silent, as to whether he learned Hebrew early on as a language or it was only Egyptian, but usually little kids speak the same language as their mother. So we don't know how long the mother had was able to care for the baby. But he knew at some point that intellectually that he was of the Hebrew people, and now he was of age and came to visit his brethren. Now, they were in a land in the northern part of Egypt, land called Goshen, that was reserved for shepherds because shepherds and the care of sheep was kind of an abomination to the Egyptians, so they put him off in one direction. So here's 40 years old, and he goes to visit them. And what does he see when he visits? In Exodus 2, verse 11, it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. He could see they were being, forced labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. We learned earlier the Pharaoh had set taskmasters over them, people to make sure that they got all the work done. And we have pictures in the hieroglyphics of taskmasters with whips, making sure that the Hebrew slaves were doing what they were doing. Well, Moses saw this, and so what does it say in verse 12? He looked this way and that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. So it had to be a pretty egregious thing that happened at that time, and likely near a river because there was sand there. So Moses now has now identifying with the children of Israel. Well, verse 15, when Pharaoh heard of the matter, he said, oh, don't do that again. You're one of my kind, you know, you got to be careful. Or was he angry? And of course, we read he's angry because he sought to kill Moses. And then we read on in verse 15, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Moses was no fool here. He got out of town. He knew he was dead meat if he stuck around, so he left in a hurry, apparently by himself, and traveled a long way. Now, if we take a look at a map, where is Midian? Is it like going here from Arkansas to Oklahoma or Missouri? No, not quite. It's traveling across the Sinai Peninsula, and some of the maps show it just over into what is currently Saudi Arabia. And some of them say that's where Mount Sinai is. So he had some familiarity with that area. Now, Moses spent 40 years in the wilderness, and God decided it was time because apparently the older Pharaoh had died off, and so that Moses could then return to Egypt. God spoke to him directly. And at the time of the burning bush, we have Exodus 4, but in verse 2, he demonstrated very clearly that God's power would work through Moses and as well as through Aaron. And so this is the explanation of when in verse 40, chapter Exodus 4 in verse 2, the Lord said to him, what's in your hand? And he said, a rod. Well, he had a staff, a walking staff, but that staff was also important as a defense item, so that should there be a wolf or other vermin or an unruly person, he could defend himself. And God said to cast it on the ground, verse 3. And so Moses cast it on the ground and became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. I don't know how many of you have been close to a serpent. I have. It's very uncomfortable. About the size of my arm, at least 6 feet long. Body coming right up to look at me, about 3 feet off the ground. And I decided it was to do just like Moses. And I fled. Okay, I understand that fully because it's unexpected when that occurs. And certainly this had to be unexpected for Moses. And verse 4, and Moses, the Lord said to Moses, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. How many of us would be willing to do that? To bend over, reach over. That means you got to circle around the serpent to get to where the tail is, because the serpent's probably looking to defend itself. Reach out your hand and take it by the tail. And he caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. So in other words, it isn't just have faith. You have to exercise that faith by actually doing something. And he grabbed a hold of the serpent, and it returned to become a rod again. So this was pretty convincing at this point. For Moses, he knew that God would be with him. Now, how old was Moses at this time? We read in Exodus 7, verse 7. He heads back to Egypt, and we read that Moses was 80 years old. So he left Egypt when he was age 40. He's coming back to Egypt when he's age 80. That means he spent 40 years in the land of Midian, and then came back, met his brother, who was 3 years older, and his sister Miriam was older than that, a little older than that. I read up on it, and all the commentaries have a hard time coming up with an exact age. They're all guessing, basically. Probably good guesses, but Miriam is older than Aaron. So Moses and Aaron spoke to Pharaoh. So we know that Moses had 40 years in Egypt, 40 years in Midian, and as we'll come to see, the next 40 years were where? In the wilderness, until he died at age 120. So you can divide Moses' life up into 40, 40, and 40. Now we have Moses and Aaron, and they go through the plagues, the 10 plagues, as God was exercising or demonstrating to Pharaoh the strength of God and compelling the Pharaoh to decide to let the people of Israel leave. Now, it would devastate their economy, and that was made the Pharaoh pretty nervous. They were going to lose their workforce. Half the people would be gone. Their slaves would be gone. Now who's going to do the work? And who could they lord it over? So we have the plagues. The scripture actually says the Nile was turned to blood, but nominally the Nile was their source of water. So we all commonly refer to the first plague as the water turned to blood. And if you've seen the movie, The Ten Commandments, they really graphically put it out. It's not only did the river Nile turned to blood, but in the movie they have the guy has a goblet of water, and he's shocked, and he pours it out, and the goblet in the water in the goblet. It's a very uncomfortable thought that all the water would be that. We don't know that part, but we do know the Nile turned to blood. There was a plague of the frogs, and at this time of year you can hear frogs. What if you could hear frogs and see frogs? Now, it was many years ago, my sister-in-law went to Hawaii, a young single gal, to the feast, and a young man took her on a date. And if you've been to Hawaii, you know it rains a lot. There's a lot of frogs. And she was wearing those spiky heels on her shoes, and she was being escorted back to her motel after they had dinner. And she managed to spike a frog right square in the middle. And she's freaking out, screaming this frog was you know, on the spiked heel. And the young man, being the gentleman that he was, grabbed a hold of her ankle and was removing the frog. And all of the motel doors started coming open with a screaming woman and a man hanging onto her ankle. everybody can have their frog stories like anything else, but I remember that one in particular. The lice, that's an uncomfortable thing. You know, I've been a teacher for many years, and I had a student that was scratching away, and she pulls a louse off of her head and said, "May I be excused?" "Of course. Please go." Flies. Flies hang around rotting, decomposing things. That's part of nature's cycle. Has to be very uncomfortable. And then pestilence, which is the old, King James version of diseased livestock. Well, what happens when you have diseased livestock? They don't all live. And if you thought you had flies before, you're going to have more now. So these plagues were really, and we can go over this a little more in depth sometime. Maybe I'll have to develop it. But that's got to be an uncomfortable situation there. Six, this is not my favorite, boils. Now, I've had two boils. I think I was 12 or 13 years old at the time. Right on the top of my shoulder, left a couple of big ugly scars. And, oh, like a humongous zit, as it were. It was just painful all the time. Some kind of Staphylococcus aureus infection of that. And so now I think of it. When I see the drawings, like the Basil Wolverton drawings of these lumps of boils all over the body, and then you read about there was no comfort. And we read in other places like Job, the boils, the only soft place that they could lie down for comfort was in a bed of ashes. And I thought, well, how dirty. But you know what? Ashes are very soft. It's probably one of the few soft places they could really find. Give it. What a terrible. Thunderstorm of hail and fire. You know, I've been through some remarkable weather. On July 11th, 1968, I had all weather in one day in Minnesota. There was a snowstorm, hail, tornadoes, sunshine, and rainbows and rain. Now, I didn't have fire coming down. But I'm thinking all of this occurred in one day, and a remarkable thing happened. It happened exactly 1 year later in July 11th of 69. That all happened, and I'm thinking, now that's a really odd day. How do you suppose these people thought? There's a thunderstorm, had hail and fire come down. The best that now I've heard an explanation as to how that could happen when you have burning hail coming down. And that was by a scientist who said it could be the hydrocarbons from the tail of a comet that swung by, rained hydrocarbons down, and they ignited coming through the atmosphere. It's got to be a bad day for that one. Locusts. Think grasshoppers. They eat everything that they can see in sight. It would be my grandfather's cousin married a fellow in Kansas. Now, a Minnesota girl, and during the Dust Bowl years, grasshoppers came and ate everything. And they moved back up to Minnesota, and she told the story that green grasshoppers were everywhere and they ate everything. But the chickens loved grasshoppers. She said, that was fine, except that the egg whites were green. The yolks were green. Everything was green. Made me think of Dr. Seuss. So some locusts, well, that might be okay. But when there's locusts everywhere, stripping everything. Darkness for 3 days. Sounds like some kind of blockage of the sun. Ought to be pretty convincing. We know that Christopher Columbus had that experience, and he being a navigator, called attention to it, and he told the natives that had captured him, "If you don't let me go, I'll block out the sun." And they didn't believe him, and then the sun stopped shining, and it would block it out, and they let him go. Well, but for 3 days. That had to be pretty convincing. I think it was, 1889, there was a summer, the year of no summer, where Mount Krakatoa blew in Indonesia, covered the earth with ashes, and as a result, they were lucky to make much hay for the livestock because there was a lot less sun. But that was, you still had sun. Here, darkness for 3 days. Candles get burnt pretty short. And finally, you have the 10th plague, death of the firstborn throughout the land. It's afflicted except those who had marked the blood on the post for Passover. The death angel visited every family. So the plagues were pretty strenuous responses from God for failure to let the people of Israel go. Well, and the 10th plague with the death of the firstborn, we read in Exodus 12, verses 7 and 8, for the Hebrew people were told to take some blood, put it on the doorposts, on the sides and over the top of the houses where they were to eat the lamb. Verse 8, and they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, they shall eat it. Now, I don't know what kind of herbs they used. I don't know what they mean by bitter. But I do know that I like seasoning, but I don't know the details here. But it was a specific instruction with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. In other words, don't take the time to bake up bread. Bake it, mix the dough, and bake it unleavened. So Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt. Off they went, brought Israel from the Red Sea. God created a series of miracles for which they were able to cross the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness and 3 days. Now, how long can you last without water? About 3 days. It's pretty old right about that time. And this was a place called Marah, verse 23, Exodus 15, 23. Couldn't drink the water. They finally found water because the water was bitter. Now, if you've traveled in the West, you know that there's alkali lakes. And if you've seen some of those, and nobody can, animals and people can't drink from those. Well, here they had bitter water, but there was God performed a miracle to make that water sweet. And so they were good. But that wasn't the only case, because this was just after 3 days. If we read in Exodus 17, there was another occasion when they didn't have water in the wilderness. So if you're going through an area that doesn't have a lot of water, now mind you, how many people are there? We're looking about 2 million people and their livestock, which means there's a whole lot of thirsty mouths that have to be fed. So we read Exodus 17, verse 1, all the congregation of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. And of course, they were all gracious and quiet and said, oh, God will provide something. Or was there another explanation? Well, of course, it was a quite different explanation as to what they actually did. And Exodus 17, verse 3, the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, why is it you brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with their thirst? In other words, you must have evil motives. You, as the Egyptian, raised in as Egyptian, brought us out here to kill us and get rid of all of us. In other words, they're suspecting his loyalty at this point. And verse 4, Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with these people? They love me so much, or they're almost ready to stone me. Stoning, apparently, was the culturally appropriate way to deal with somebody who was a traitor. And they assumed that he must be a traitor because he brought them out there to die. Not a good thing. You can see why Moses was pleading, why he was crying out. And of course, God again performed a miracle there. If we read in Exodus 17, water and food weren't their only problems. There were enemies. Now, in Exodus 17 and verse 8, it says Amalek. Now, people were named after their ruler, after their leader. So Amalek was their leader, and his people were called Amalekites. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it in the native language the way they did, 3,000 years ago. So they came, and they obviously felt threatened. Here's 2 million people and all their livestock encroaching in their area. So they're going to strike out. And Moses sees them as a threat as well. Verse 9, and Moses says to Joshua, choose some men, go out and fight with Amalek. In other words, let's get prepared. We can see they're coming. Probably see the dust of the horses in the background and how they're trying to surround the camp. Don't know the details. We aren't given all of that. But what does Moses say? Tomorrow I'll stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. That's the same rod that was turned, that God turned into a serpent. Moses called it the rod of God. So verse 10, Joshua did as Moses said. In other words, he organized an army, fought with Amalek, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill where they could observe what was going on. So what happens? When Moses held up his hand, verse 11, that Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. So we have Moses holding up his hands over on the hill, and then the Israelites would prevail in battle. But, you know, have you ever wondered how a barber can hold their arms up all day long? That's got to be hard. Holding your hands, just go ahead, try it for a minute or two. How about 5, 10? How about an hour? What happens? Your arms get heavier and heavier and heavier. What seems simple at first becomes grievous as time goes on. Verse 12, Moses' hands became heavy. They were the same weight as they were before, but they felt heavy. So they took a stone and put under him. They rolled something over. He could sit down, so he wasn't sitting on the ground. And he sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side, one on the other. They stood up, and each one held a hand so that Moses' hands were still up. Because what happens when he put his hands down? Then Amalek would prevail. And they had to hold his hands up until the going down of the sun, until sundown. Why did they quit fighting at sundown? You can't tell who's who when it's all dark out. And by that time, Joshua's army defeated Amalek and his people at the edge of the sword. So it was really another remarkable miracle where God worked through Moses and what Moses called the rod of God to defeat the Amalekites. We read, as we covered recently, how God made a holy nation out of Israel. And he did that as a precursor for Christians preparing to go into the kingdom. And here he was preparing a physical nation to go into the promised land. But this is our prototype, our foretype of spiritual Israel. We read in 1 Peter 2:9 about spiritual Israel being a holy nation who is going to go into the, being prepared to go into the kingdom of God. 1 Peter 2:9, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. The people, the children of Israel, had 40 years to do what? Learn the Sabbath, learn the commandments of God. They had stone tablets that marked it out, so you couldn't change it. They couldn't misremember anything. It was all laid out before them right there. So this was a critical development in developing a nation of what was originally Jacob and then his 70 descendants, and then grew to what appears to be 2 million people. So this is just prior to going into the Promised Land. So we've covered the a little bit of the life of Moses. We've covered some of the plagues that were laid out, and some of the Exodus as they approached the Promised Land and 40 years.